with winds up to 20 miles per hour. Right now, wind south at 6. It is 54 degrees in Kenosha, now 51 in Racine. Wind is from the south at 6. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Now 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm delighted, as always, to be able to welcome back into our studios a very good friend of the morning show, Dr. Art Sear. And Dr. Art Sear, of course, visits us on a monthly basis to talk about various issues and concern, many of them related to foreign policy. And Professor Sear's columns appear in newspapers and journals all across the country. He's also author of After the Cold War, and we have a lot of really interesting things to explore today. And Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you. Such a nice, warm and sunny greeting on what was a cold and wet morning until a little while ago.
But that's right. We're glad you
arrived at WGTD. Suddenly the clouds cleared and the sun appeared.
And all is sunshine and
optimism. Yeah, I associate that with you. Thank you.
Good to have you here. I'm glad we can have a conversation about a number of different things. Some of what we'll talk about have been explored in your recent columns. A couple of things I did want to ask you about, and one of them is some of the troubles that surround U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and the fact that some major concerns have been raised about some of the gifts that he has accepted over over recent years from a billionaire and major GOP donor by the name of Harlan Crow. And as I kind of read up about this, I realized that I had not understood this thing called the Ethics in Government Act, which affects justices, including the Supreme Court justices, and what they are required by law to disclose. And I don't know, I guess maybe I, like many Americans, kind of think of the U.S. Supreme Court as kind of sequestered in their own dominion and largely untouched by the things that kind of control the rest of us, and that's just simply not true. What can you tell us about what Clarence Thomas has done that has generated this criticism, and if there's any precedent for it? I mean, is this something we've seen before in terms of the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, you're right. The U.S. Supreme Court is the third separate part of the government, along with the executive and legislative branches. Given the media tempest, in dominant electronic media especially, I think it's important to say that it's not at all clear he's done anything wrong. I do think if you're in a senior position, you've got to be extremely careful, in the public sector especially. And to actually answer your question, in the wake of the great difficulty in our country during the Vietnam and Watergate years, very divisive war followed by a very destructive political, really destructive political controversy and crisis, rather detailed laws were passed, which is all to the good, about what members of our government have to do in terms of revealing expenses and other things. I think taking generous gifts from a very wealthy, influential business person in either party is not wise today. And at the same time, it's not at all clear that the justice actually broke any rules. I think appearance is important, given the criticism. He's been a target since the highly divisive confirmation hearings during the George H.W. Bush administration. The Wall Street Journal, in its news coverage, I believe, has been very clear and specific, and in its editorial pages, they have long supported the justice, and I think it's well worth referring to them if you really want to get into the weeds of the current regulations and whether or not Justice Thomas has broken them.
Right.
But beyond that, the appearance is important. I think he made a mistake. I admire him personally. He's an individual who started absolutely dirt poor, and his professional success is just incredible. People who are quite prominent, also admirable, who are seen as African-American leaders generally have come from considerable privilege. In some cases, they're immigrants who quite understandably nowadays stress their non-white heritage, so to speak. But he's someone, an African-American, who came from absolute poverty to great success.
Hmm. Well, it'll be interesting to follow and see where all of this goes. And to be clear, he has, in a sense, admitted some wrongdoing, if not violation of the law. I mean, he has apologized, if I understand correctly, for
Well, take a look at the details. I think you and I should, if we're really interested, should take a look at the details. It's not at all clear to me that he actually violated anything.
Appearances
are important.
Right. I'm not saying he did. I'm just saying, though, in terms of his statements in the wake of this, he has expressed some regret for not having disclosed the full nature of some of what he's received from Mr. Crow. I mean, but admitting, you know, a lapse in judgment or a mistake, whatever you want to call it, that does not mean you're admitting that you violated a law. That is very clear.
You asked about precedent. Back in the 1960s, Abe Fortas, a very, very successful attorney and judge and a very, very intelligent person and a close friend of President Lyndon Johnson, was confirmed for the court, I think, in 1965. And then when Chief Justice, longtime and very historically important Republican, but very liberal, Chief Justice Earl Warren retired, President Johnson nominated Fortas for the Chief Justice position. Abe Fortas had taken a lot of money from a lot of different people over time. And more and more of this personal history, quite different from Justice Thomas, started to come out. And so he quite wisely retired.
Hmm.
Again, he was never indicted, never convicted. The evidence is clear that in contrast to Thomas, he was a guy who was a little too interested in money. Same accusations could be made about President Johnson. It was a very different time.
Right.
LBJ also was never indicted or convicted and did a lot of good as president. And there are other precedents regarding Supreme Court controversy. Beyond the Wall Street Journal, Mitch McConnell, a very, very successful, another very successful politician in the Republican Party. I think his judicious comments about the Supreme Court being a separate branch, Democrats are now in full attack mode against Clarence Thomas, including Chuck Schumer, the very vocal Democratic leader in the Senate. I think McConnell has been very judicious in saying this is another branch of government, and let's leave it to Chief Justice John Roberts, as well as the law, to handle this. I happen to admire Roberts a lot. I think he's been a leavening force against the far-right ideologues who now have the majority on the court.
Hmm.
Or maybe not ideologues, extremely conservative justices who now have the majority on the court. So insofar as we can see from the outside, I'd say pay attention to what Chief Justice Roberts seems to be doing in a very, very tough job.
Right. Very good.
Well, I'm glad it's very good.
I wonder if you have anything to say about the headline-generating lawsuit brought by Dominion against Fox News. And, of course, Dominion, I think, is a company that provides and services electronic balloting machinery. And
yes.
they brought a defamation lawsuit against Fox News, contending that Fox News had willingly and consciously and very deliberately spread all kinds of falsehoods about Dominion and their products. And this defamation lawsuit was their response, and that was settled out of court just, it seemed like, moments before the trial was scheduled to commence. But it feels like, I suspect you have a longer view of this, and it's maybe not as unprecedented as it might kind of appear as a glance, but I just wonder if you feel like there is lasting significance to this particular case, even though it has been, as I said, settled out of court.
Yes, Dominion had sued Fox because of the factually incorrect claims by former President Trump and his most intense supporters that the 2020 election was stolen, and accusations of election fraud, for which there is so far zero evidence, thanks to Trump, have been very prominent and much debated. Dominion, I believe, handles some actual election machines, and they sued accusing Fox of knowingly and maliciously defrauding them and slandering them. And I'm very glad it didn't go to trial. My understanding, I'm not a lawyer or an expert on the law or the justice system, but I do follow, and you asked me to look into this, saying you wanted to talk about it. Civil suits tend to be settled before a trial. Judge Davis, speaking of the judicial system, the Delaware judge in charge, he clearly was pressing the two sides to settle. He gave them some extra time, a day or two before trial, so they could settle. I think Dominion wanted $1.6 billion and settled for about half that, $7.65. I don't know. My poor mind boggles with these gigantic zeros and dollar signs.
Right.
Yes, I'm about to faint here. Professor Berg, maybe you are too. But he was clearly pressing to settle. He also said in open court that Fox lied. Evidence that he saw as the judge showed that Fox executives had cynically and knowingly lied about what were factual matters. My personal opinion, inexpert, is that the judge was being very, very helpful to our country by saying that, in effect, in advance, is the case against Fox already seems pretty clear to me. In that sense, he was protecting the First Amendment. They settled. A lot of Fox celebrities did not have to testify as witnesses and be embarrassed by very high-priced, highly paid, aggressive attorneys. I mean, this is big-time law and big-time courtroom stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The First Amendment is extraordinarily important. We're the only country that has it, freedom of speech. And had this proceeded to trial, I think it could have had a dampening effect on honest, hard-charging investigative reporters who are trying to find the truth. Corporate power and government power is tremendous, and the First Amendment protects us all from oppressive censorship by private as well as public interests. I hope that's clear, but from what I've learned, scrambling around late last night doing homework, sir, I think Judge Davis is really our system at its best.
Interesting. Yeah, well, and right,
it's interesting, and I hope it's clear.
Right, and of course, this I think anyone on whatever side of the aisle you're on would have to agree that this has ultimately been quite damaging to Fox News and its reputation. I mean, because of exactly what you just said in terms of what the judge stated quite unequivocally.
I mean,
even though they settled, it's not like, in a sense, Fox News got off scot-free. I mean, they are emerging from this, it seems to me, with having been hurt by these kind of revelations.
The company has not apologized publicly, but clearly the evidence is clear, including deposition testimony by Rupert Murdoch, the 92-year-old chairman of the enormous Fox Corporation, that there was a lot of cynicism and profit-making involved. I first became aware of him many years ago. I was a grad student, very blessed. I was working in England on my PhD dissertation, and he was much in the news. He was the maestro, the czar of tabloid newspapers, and British tabloids are the most absurd and ridiculous of any tabloids. You know, the National Enquirer is pretty ugly, but British tabloids are comical and they're outrageous, and there's no First Amendment, so they're always suing each other over there. He was regularly hauled before Parliament. And as an impressionable young man, I was impressed by the great wealth of this character. He also had the most fantastic social life. He had this kind of endless stream of English girlfriends, if I might say so, and he was always in the tabloids. And I was kind of fascinated and horrified, but they couldn't. Very aggressive British MPs could never actually lay a finger on him in terms of breaking the law. He was quite notorious and quite successful and quite rich, and apparently he's going to live forever. So make up your own mind.
Right.
But it's not fair and balanced. It's modern electronic media.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear. He is a monthly visitor to The Morning Show, and we're talking about a number of different things. And since we're talking right now about journalism and the First Amendment and so on, I think it's important for us to talk about the shocking arrest of an American reporter for the Wall Street Journal by Russian forces. And you wrote very recently about this and expressed very, very grave concern about, among other things, kind of the escalating repression that we are seeing in Russian, thanks to Vladimir Putin. And of course, your column went on to kind of spell out other instances in which various journalists and so on have been taken into custody or attacked or poisoned and so on. It really is kind of a shocking litany, of which this is just the first. What more do you think we need to say about the plight of Aaron Gershkovich? I think it's
Evan Gershkovich.
Yeah, Gershkovich.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly, but his parent, as the name implies, his parents were Jewish emigres from Russia, which has a long history, from the Soviet Union, I beg your pardon, in 1979. A country which has a long history of anti-Semitism. They were able to get to the United States in 1979. Very, very successful professional people here. I'm sure they're very proud of his son, who's the best kind of news reporter. Fox News, which owns the Wall Street Journal, in fairness to Rupert and Fox, people were really worried, as when he bought the Times of London, buying everything in the media. He's respected the professionalism and the good reputation of the Journal. They have been rightly outraged. President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, who seems to me to be one of the really strong players and not a publicity seeker in this administration, have been rightly being very aggressive in pursuing release of this poor young man. Russian security hearings are always held in private. We don't know what the evidence is against him. I'm extremely doubtful, 100% skeptical, that he, in fact, is guilty of spying. We use spies, they use spies, countries should use spies, they're important. But they're important to our own security and to freedom. But this case seems particularly outrageous, and the evidence I marshaled is this long history of persecution and oppression and murder of journalists, women as well as men, in Russia by the Putin regime.
Yeah,
so it's a terrible case, and Biden himself, the best evidence is innocent. Usually the government will say nothing, or
be diplomatic about it. The president's been very blunt, along with, and we should be very proud of them as Americans. This man has to be released. This is an utter outrage. He's an innocent American citizen.
Right. You characterize,
I brought it up. It's terrible. Excuse me.
Yeah, you characterize it as the latest assault on freedom by Vladimir Putin. One of the things you said towards the end of the column is, we must actively seek levers to secure the release of Griskovich. That's an interesting way to put it. Why did you use the term levers, or how are you using the term levers?
Well, we have a number of agents of theirs under arrest, and Putin is seems to be quite anxious, more anxious than the Soviets. His position is weaker, but he's always very interested in exchanging them. There's a man named Karstens, I think it's Carstens, a retired CIA professional, retired military officer, I believe, who is the State Department person in charge of these negotiations, which are, they've got to be exhausting emotionally. He has to deal with, he deals with American families as well as the Russians and others who are holding our people.
Hard to imagine.
And especially with the end of the Cold War, grabbing someone from the U.S. is great way to get money, a great way to get your own people back. And Putin seems to be quite anxious to use this leverage. And our leverage is returning people to them.
Hmm. I was
African-American woman athlete, Greising?
I don't remember.
She, much in the news. She was exchanged.
Oh, right, yes. I don't remember the name, yeah.
She's a black woman and an athlete, very prominent in NPR. She was exchanged for one of their people that has been held by the American government.
So you're thinking that, you know, this may ultimately be resolved in a similar way.
Yeah, I think publicity is important in this case. And it does pressure the Russian government in very real ways, and they do want to get their people back. Skillful intelligence agents. It's a difficult job. It's a very gray area of life, I can say with assurance. And it's extremely important for every nation state. And with the deterioration of our relations with Russia, it's not a new Cold War, contrary to the media, but times are tough right now with this war in Ukraine. It becomes particularly important. Mm.
I was surprised to read in your column, you said this was the first arrest of a U.S. journalist by Russia since the end of the Cold War.
Yes.
And I guess I hadn't stopped to consider that, but that really actually is the case, and that's part of what makes this all the more shocking.
Yes. Well, the Journal is a very fine publication. I tend to be conservative. I certainly don't agree with a lot of their very conservative editorial positions, but it remains a very professional newspaper at a time when professional journalism, I don't want to offend anyone, but professional journalism...
In retreat, shall we say.
Well, profit above all has come to dominate the media. The fairness doctrine, which was very important, along with professional standards that have just simply deteriorated in this country, especially since the 1980s with the end of the fairness doctrine, and the growth of cable, and the growth of the internet, the news business is no longer the news business.
Or it's a news business in a more of a business way than it was before.
Yeah. Which is the way it used to be. Hmm. It's a fascinating subject for which I've not seen any really insightful answer. Hmm. Lots of opinions. But in the 19th century, news reporting was very partisan and very outrageous. And tabloids were pervasive. In the 20th century, professionalism started to develop in the West. And why that happened, I don't think anyone is sure, but it sure as hell has deteriorated.
Right.
In this century especially.
Right. We're slipping back to the not-so-good old days when it comes to the media.
Oh, yeah. Look at with the internet, all kinds of things. It's fascinating. You can spend your whole life. I'm always tempted, instead of working, you can just go through this old material. So Soviet archives are still being released. Despite the crackdown, there's a very interesting article on the Cuban Missile Crisis in the just-published issue of Foreign Affairs, the Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, about the missile crisis. And the author's Russia experts, one of them is a Russian, I think, documents that are still being released by Moscow. So it's fascinating. But 19th century news reporting was just almost unbelievable. Editorial cartoons of Abraham Lincoln candidate embracing a black woman with obvious physical overtones in a major Chicago newspaper.
Right.
Yeah. It just
speaking of outrageous.
Yeah. Crudeness that I'm sorry to say has come back. It's not unprecedented, but these archives are just fascinating. You can do. I tell our students at Carthage how lucky they are, because I used to have to go into the library stacks and actually go through old newspapers.
Yeah, and the Guide to Periodic Literature and all kinds of other things.
The card index.
Oh, yes.
Yes. I asked a student in the library now some years ago for the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature, these big, boring, green volumes.
Mm-hmm.
You had to dust them off. He didn't know what I was talking about.
Right. Thankfully. So I appreciated so much the eloquence of that column. And
although
I think a lot of us certainly share your sense of outrage, I thought you really spelled out both the ways in which this is kind of just the latest in a long succession of terrible things done by Russia, but that there is something especially outrageous about this particular instance. And in particular, I think you characterized Mr. Kirskovich at one point as a most unlikely foreign agent. I mean, I think that's what you were saying earlier, that there's just no way that what the Russians are charging him with can possibly be true. And he really does deserve release.
Yeah, it's a very cynical and very sadistic move. In the current environment, professional news organizations who employed spies or professional journalists who were active agents, including for our government, that would be the end of your career.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm skeptical.
Right. Well, we'll certainly follow that with great interest. Another story we're following with great interest, in which you wrote about in really interesting fashion, where what you characterize and have been characterized as massive protests in the nation of France. And I just wanted to mention parenthetically, I had heard something about this because my niece is married to a young woman from France. And actually the two of them have been in France in recent weeks, and so have seen up close and personal some of the ramifications and consequences of these massive protests. Before we talk about kind of the nature of the protests and the instability in France, maybe you can recount for our listeners what President Macron did that sparked such widespread and vociferous protests across the country.
Well, like every industrial nation, including the good old USA, they have a rapidly growing, aging population, although we are the only country, it's important to emphasize, thanks to immigration and populations that have a very active birth rate, Islamic Americans and Latino Americans, not African Americans. That population's been around 11% since before the Civil War, but we have a very robust young population in this country. Especially important to keep in mind, given political and educational emphasis on an aging population for reasons that have nothing to do with demographics. The United States is in a very good position overall. Japan's in the worst. But pension burdens are growing, including in the U.S., because that population is literally expanding. And I'm one of them, and I'm very glad myself I'm still around. To actually give you a straight answer, Macron wants to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64, I believe. France has a long history of revolution, very violent radicalism, including a very active Communist Party movement, and very, very tough, at times violent, communist trade unions. A culture that's very different from our own, for example, historically. And so they're taking to the streets again and demonstrating again. France seemed to be on the verge of actual collapse in the 1950s after revolving door, weak governments, and a very fractured political culture, again, unlike ours and some other places. And General Charles de Gaulle, the leader of the free, really heroic leader of the free French in World War II, came back as president. He'd been president briefly right after the war. And he put in place the Fifth Republic, including a constitution with very strong executive authority. And he, that along with his unique personal characteristics and ability to appeal to the population overall after the war, not during, he created stability, just an incredible leader, which has lasted, and he gave the president a lot of power. And Macron, who's been in power for a while, he was recently reelected, has been increasingly willing to use that executive power. Hmm. He has a lot of executive authority. He's not that strong in the parliament. He's still relatively young. He made a tremendous amount of money in financial services and investment banking at a young age. And he and his wife come from very influential families, I believe. So we'll see how long he lasts.
Right. It sounds like, yeah, there's a couple things going on here. One of them is what he did. I mean, this, you know, with the stroke of a pen, essentially.
Exactly.
Changing the retirement age from 62 to 64 and then stipulating, as you told us in the column, that people must work for 43 years in order to qualify for a full pension. But so, you know, that's what he did. But the fact is how he did it was by executive order. It did not go through maybe the normal pathways of the parliament in order for this to be enacted. And it sounds like that's a big reason why people are even more upset than they otherwise would be.
Yeah, but one point very well put, and one point I was trying to get across is since 1789 and the French Revolution, they've always been upset. they used to be the weak link or the so-called sick man of Europe in earlier times. However, they're also a very good ally of the United States. We don't, especially here on the media, sir, we don't want to overstate things. They're a very reliable ally of the U.S. De Gaulle was a strong nationalist. He believed strongly that the NATO alliance, as well as the European Union, threatened French greatness and French grandeur. He was in many ways a 19th century leader, as was Churchill. Churchill and Roosevelt both got headaches from trying to deal with this character. He took France out of NATO in 1966, and the headquarters moved from Paris to, I think, Castel in Belgium. He almost wrecked the European Union in the mid-1960s. European economic community then, because he was rigidly against them getting independent economic authority. He insisted on developing his own nuclear force, which still exists. And the dueling between him and President Kennedy, very interesting personalities, not just in my opinion. It was fascinating when I was quite young to watch this tremendous contest between two highly intelligent, very different leaders. And that's all gone today. After 9/11, French aircraft, they returned to NATO, I believe, in 2009. French aircraft were among the first Allied planes to patrol U.S. and Canada airspace after the attacks of 9/11. France has a very tough military. At least in the past, our people would often poo-poo that. I heard that directly in the U.S. Army. Well, the French lost in Vietnam, but who the hell cares? That's the they're all wimps. Totally false. Mm-hmm. French military units, including the Foreign Legion, are performing very important service to anti-terrorism in various parts of formerly their colonies in Africa. And they're faithful members of the alliance, all of which is important given the current drama in France.
Right. And I guess that's what you're saying is the unrest in France potentially has international repercussions.
It does. Yes. Excuse me, I interrupted.
It undermines the role that they are playing on the world stage, or potentially could.
France and Germany are now very close partners. The principal goal of the European union movement was to keep the Germans under control and not have the Germans launch a third horrific war, frankly, but also to get France and Germany together. It started with the European Coal and Steel Community in the early 50s, directly focused on France and Germany, and that has worked marvelously.
Mm. Well, that's another story we'll follow with great interest, we'll see if things get better or get worse. It does seem like some of the really dramatic protests that we saw at the outset have lessened a bit, but
yes.
Certainly there's still a plenty of unhappiness there.
Well, it's a good wake-up call for the president, who is a very, very, very impressive in person and leader, but it's a reminder that it is a democracy and you've got to, at some level, work with people you don't care for.
Right. You mentioned in the column that although he was reelected less than a year ago, it was by a smaller margin than the election back in 2017. So, he maybe should have taken note of that and proceeded with a little more caution than he did.
And Marine Le Pen, now the principal opposition leader, she did much better. She and her father before her are people who, rather like Trump, to a limited extent, it's very extreme populism that continues to have appeal in France and Eastern Europe, Hungary in particular, and other places. It's important not to underestimate this.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a moment about President Biden's recent four-day visit to Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. It sounds like it was a significant visit, which also included a visit by former President Bill Clinton to mark kind of an important anniversary of something that probably a lot of us here in America have forgotten all about. But 25 years ago, it was a very, very significant achievement indeed, the so-called Good Friday Agreement or Belfast Agreement. Tell us what made that so remarkable and why it is was an important anniversary to celebrate in such a big way.
Ireland became independent from Britain after a long and often violent and really brutal history of ethnic violence. They were part of the British Empire until 1921. It is an overwhelmingly Catholic nation. There is a Protestant enclave, a Protestant majority, in Northern Ireland. The capital is Ulster, and they remain part of the United Kingdom along with England, Scotland, and Wales. And things were relatively stable until the late 1960s when extremist fanatical elements of the Irish Republican Army, the traditional revolutionary group, reemerged and went back into action. And there was sustained, not frequent, but sustained, often shocking violence, not only in Northern Ireland, but in Ireland itself, the Republic, and in Britain. An IRA bomb almost killed Margaret Thatcher and members of her cabinet in Southeast Asia during her years in power. My oldest son, David, and I went to England on a trip after he graduated from high school in the early 1990s. We stayed at the Carlton Club, the Conservative Party Club. These places are interesting, and they're generally, if you can get in, a lot cheaper than hotels in London, especially in our time. The day after we left, the IRA bombed the club.
Wow.
And it was very thought-provoking for both my son and me. British intelligence and the British excelled at intelligence. And while we're studying how they do things, they were very good at suppressing this movement over time, but it was still troublesome. And as I say, both sides in Northern Ireland were killing leaders in both countries. Mm. It could have exploded, but the British showed intelligence skill, including targeting and killing individual members of the IRA. It is a war. They also did not send in heavy armor and lots of firepower to Northern Ireland. My strong view is we Americans tend to be a little too willing to do that. They are particularly unwilling to do that as a way of addressing militant insurgency.
That is the Britain.
Yeah, they were very good at keeping a damper on things in Northern Ireland. But if they had engaged in overkill, it could have led to general violence.
Hmm.
Given the importance of the Irish-American community here, including in politics, as you indicated, Senator George Mitchell, retired Democrat senator from Maine, was extremely important in, I don't know if Clinton recruited him or not, but he was really important in helping mediate the two sides. In the 1970s, four prominent Irish-American politicians, Governor Hugh Carey and Senator Pat Moynihan from New York, and in Massachusetts, well-known Senator Ted Kennedy, and Tip O'Neill, who was also the Speaker of the House of Representatives, issued a statement imploring Irish Americans to stop sending money to the IRA. And that, I've read, had a huge impact in cutting off what had been a lot of money from mostly working people in this country going to the IRA radical wing. And finally, in 1998, Tony Blair's government, British Prime Minister, was able to reach an accord that has been shaky, but has held. It was very, very difficult. There, on at least one occasion, the Irish, I believe the ambassador to Britain, discovered that his limousine was wired and maybe his office as well. It's an armed conflict, but it was not easy, but the British worked through it. I believe they're the one colonial power that avoided any kind of really lengthy quagmire, even though they had by far the biggest empire on Earth.
Hmm.
And I believe strongly their methods are very helpful for us.
Right. Yeah, an interesting
lesson. I believe that very strongly, and it's rarely mentioned, so I appreciate the chance to emphasize that.
Yeah, fascinating story.
Yeah.
In our last couple minutes, we should talk about something that you recently wrote about the nation of Taiwan and what you characterized as what amounts to kind of a political tightrope in terms of how they can peacefully coexist with their looming neighbor on the mainland, namely, of course, China.
Very looming.
Right. And so...
Lots of looming. Really big.
Right. So you were talking about the president of Taiwan's recent visit to the United States and how that visit was handled in such an interesting and sort of savvy way to not attract the wrong kind of attention and criticism. Explain the nature of her visit to the United States, how this was handled, and why you think this was a very, very good way to handle it.
President Tsai Ing-wen did not go to Washington and wouldn't. We have diplomatic relations with Beijing, not with Taiwan. You can't have both. She went to New York and met with a Chinese-American organization or two, and then she went to Central America. There are a couple small countries and territories in the Pacific and here and there that the Taiwanese maintain diplomatic relations with. They feel that's really important for them. So she went down to Central America, then she came back north, went to L.A., and met with very prominent Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. He and President Biden are currently battling about whether America is going to go broke or not, as you may have noticed in the news, the impending debt ceiling. Anyway, at the Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, just north of Los Angeles, she had a very good meeting with Kevin McCarthy. And, of course, Beijing went wild in terms of propaganda and shooting off weapons around Taiwan and screaming in outrage. The dragon really went nuts, as usual. And then she went back home. They are very skillful at maintaining strong relations with the United States without provoking war with China so far. She's from the DPP, the Democratic Progressive Party, which is a Taiwan party. The main opposition is the KMT, the Kuomintang, the old Nationalist Party, which retreated to Taiwan for what most people thought would be a last stand in 1949 when the communists took over the mainland. Ironically, the KMT has better relationships with Beijing. The DPP is formally committed to independence. And Beijing, which sees Taiwan, understandably, as part of China, they have said constantly that will mean war. So the DPP, she is in a rather touchy situation. The DPP has very pragmatically avoided any kind of formal declaration of their doctrinal commitment to independence and has so far finessed the situation. A lot of younger people, the KMT, General Chiang Kai-shek, as that implies, a lot of older people support the KMT. Younger people, the growing population tends to be in favor, the new population, I beg your pardon, tends to be in favor of the DPP. It's very complicated.
Yeah, it really is. And so it sounds like what you're saying is Taiwan sees itself as an independent nation, functions as an independent nation, but they have to be really careful not to say that they are an independent nation. I mean, to declare that in any kind of formal way. And you're saying that this party currently in power, the DPP, is managing to do that, resisting the temptation, whatever there might be, to make a grand declaration of that, because that potentially could mean war with mainland China, which nobody wants.
At the same time, well stated, at the same time she made this trip with her entourage, former President Ma from the KMT, he was mayor of Taipei and then he became president for two terms, and really improved relationship with Beijing. He and a group of students were visiting various parts of the mainland, not Beijing, but he met with Chinese officials. They each denounced each other. They publicly denounced each other, Ma and Tsai. I think that may have been stage managed. I think they may have arranged this in advance. One reason why our friends throughout Asia consider us now and in the past to be kind of a pain in the neck is Americans favor the straight shooter, the direct approach, straightforward.
Right.
Asian culture is different, I've learned over some years, and an awful lot of what goes on, kind of like Chicago politics and Washington politics, an awful lot of what goes on is behind the scenes, but it's notable that Ma, who established trade relationships with the mainland, took this other group as a kind of an aspirin tablet for Beijing.
Fascinating.
It is. And commercial flights, a lot of freight traffic, sea traffic, travel between, all of this has continued to go on. It was established, the big breakthrough, I think, was around 2008, and all of that has continued. Under the surface of the Sturm und Drang of Nancy Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi going to Taiwan and Beijing freaking out.
Right.
It is a very, very tense situation. I don't minimize that, but there's a lot that's positive going on under the surface.
I was just going to say, the surface is one thing, beneath the surface is the other, and it's beneath the surface where, in a sense, real life is being lived, and where we really see the fullness of the situation.
We should all be happy as Americans, especially that the United Nations is so durable. With the end of the Cold War, it became a global institution. Russia and China now have central banks, and China especially that answers to the party. But it is a free market-style banking system. The communists don't like it, but they have to accept it. They were anxious to join the World Trade Organization, the trade management arm of the UN, now a global institution with the end of the Cold War. And we were very skillful, especially in ensuring that Taiwan and China entered the WTO as separate entities. It was worked out. President Clinton had a lot of skill as a policy president, along with obvious shortcomings. We can thank Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt for committing their nations to the United Nations before Pearl Harbor. That's incredible foresight.
Yeah.
And we're still benefiting from that.
The vision, absolutely.
Vision.
Dr. Art Sear, it is always a great pleasure to have you here. You always offer illumination on everything that we talk about, and today was no exception. Thank you so much for making time for the morning show in your schedule, and we look forward to seeing you in the month of May.